You can't be pro-insurrectionist and pro-American. And yet Trump and his MAGA supporters not only embrace political violence, but they laugh about it. At his rally, he jokes about an intruder whipped up by the big Trump lie, taking a hammer to Paul Pelosi's skull and echoing the very same words used on January 6th. Where's Nancy? And he thinks that's funny. He laughed about it. What a sick...
Puppy. You meant puppy, right?
Sure.
Puppy.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Speaking of sick puppies.
I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. We both are. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in Red Bluff and Redding, California on KFOI and Round Mountains, KKRN, up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Fairmont, West Virginia on WEFR, Seattle's KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe on most days on the internet, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, and Detour Talk. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly, infected, investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and everything else from bradblog.com. Welcome to the COVID cast, usually known as the Bradcast. More on that in a moment, but I want to quickly welcome our newest daily on-air affiliate. You heard me mention there, our newest affiliate to the Bradcast. Or to the COVID cast, take your pick. Today, that would be welcome aboard to AM 1700 WEFR West End Fairmont Radio in Fairmont, West Virginia. Desi
cool.
Doyen.
Welcome, West Virginia.
We are proud and happy to have you on our
yes.
list of daily affiliates. And we are very happy to be on the air, by the way, in West Virginia. WEFR is just starting up. Our best wishes to you and all of your hopefully many new listeners in a year that has Joe Manchin finally stepping down from his U.S. Senate seat, but maybe running for president. So we could find West Virginia in the news a bit more than often than usual these days. And with us now on the air out there, perhaps West Virginia will get a bit more real news into the state than many folks there clearly have received up until now.
Well, surely. Always a plus to have more and better news, we hope.
Welcome aboard, guys. Feel free to drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com, as I always love hearing from new listeners. We've got a guest joining us momentarily with news on the long-awaited trial challenging Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger's use of unverifiable touchscreen voting systems yet again in the critical swing state of Georgia this year. But first, hopefully we are back for good ourselves this week after a very bumpy start to the new year last week. So let's start here from my hometown paper, the Los Angeles Times. According to the Times, the winter COVID and flu season is ramping up in California and nationwide, with doctors and other experts saying the worst of the respiratory illness season is still to come. New data show pronounced recent jumps in the rate at which coronavirus and flu tests are coming back positive, as well as the number of hospital-admitted patients testing positive for the viruses. National wastewater data suggests this winter could see the highest number of coronavirus infections occurring during any given week since the first Omicron wave began in fall of 2021. Quote, "And we're probably not quite to the zenith of it yet," said Dr. Elizabeth Hudson, the regional chief of infectious diseases at Kaiser Permanente in Southern California, adding, "Looking at some of the data we can extrapolate out from the wastewater, by the time we get to about January 10 or so, we're probably going to be seeing within the U.S. about 2 million cases a day." And guess what? Turns out that Desi and I are two of those 2 million a day.
Yep.
I guess, finally, as you will recall from our first delayed show back after the holidays last week, that Desi had, yes, tested positive for COVID just after the new year. And though I had been testing negative until then, and like you, Des, had avoided the infection for a full 4 years at this point, I think.
Yeah.
The very next day, on Friday, yes, I also tested positive. So guess what Des brought me home from Texas for the holidays? You know, yeah. A box of candy would have been just fine.
Well, I wasn't happy about it myself, to be honest.
Now, in one sense, it was actually good news when I tested positive, at least for you guys, in that it meant both she and I can now be in the same room at the same time again and can, you know, physical conditions allowing, we can do a show together again.
Yes, which was very helpful to be able to do that.
Yeah, well, that was the problem that we were really struggling with the last week when you tested positive and when I did not. That problem, as well as, you know, your health.
Yes.
And mine. Really, in addition to that good news that both of us had tested positive, we can at least be in the same room, and so now we are. The other good news is that we are both feeling, yes, much better, thank you, which what I would attribute to almost immediately upon testing positive, getting prescriptions for the antiviral Paxlovid medicine, which almost immediately seemed to be knocking it out of our systems. Would you agree with that,
Des? Yes, the symptoms went away pretty fast, I have to say.
They really did. Almost immediately after beginning the Paxlovid, and happily, those prescriptions cost us nothing. So I'm going to assume that is thanks to, yes, Joe Biden and the American CARES Act covering the costs. Really, I was feeling better about within 24 hours after testing positive because of that. And today, I'm pretty much feeling about 90-95% of normal. Desi, you finally tested negative, and I am barely still registering on the tests, barely. But that will likely be clear, I think, by tomorrow on the at-home COVID tests, also paid for by the government and our Obamacare plans. So we are still hedging our bets, staying away from pretty much everyone but each other for a few more days. But lessons learned after our first bout with COVID. Always have plenty of COVID tests on hand.
True. And make sure you're vaccinated, too.
And, yes, get your shots. Both Desi and I were fully vaxxed and boosted, and thus, at least for me anyway, I felt like my body sort of recognized what was going on, even though I had never actually been infected before. By the way, you can get COVID tests for free at covidtests.gov. And I think my biggest lesson, as soon as you test positive, ask for a prescription of Paxlovid and start taking it immediately, because you'll start feeling better within days of that positive test. Your recovery time is likely going to be much faster. And really, you know, it was almost immediately began happening in both of our cases after we began the 5-day regimen of Paxlovid. Any other lessons before we move on to actual news, Desi?
No, just continue to take precautions, because not only are you protecting yourself and your loved ones, you are protecting all of the loved ones of all of the people who come into contact with you.
Yes, good point. Now, according to the LA Times, the good news is the number of people becoming seriously ill remains lower than last year. That's good news. Nationally, however, there were almost 35,000 new coronavirus positive hospital admissions for the week, 35,000 that for the week that ended on December 30. That's a 20% jump over the prior week. And it's the highest one-week total in nearly a year. Since October 1, the CDC has reported an average of about 1,400 COVID deaths a week nationally. So, yes, it is still deadly, though so far this season somewhat less than over the same time period last year when there were about 2,400 weekly COVID deaths. Doctors recommend getting a fresh COVID-19 and flu vaccine this winter, which many people have not yet done, incredibly enough. Also for babies and pregnant people and older adults, an RSV immunization is also recommended. So if you haven't done so lately, please get that latest vaccine booster. We both did so a few months ago, and I think it would have been much worse had we not. And they are still free. And incredibly, I read that only 19% of eligible people have so far bothered to receive it, which is just amazing to me. Go do it. Be prepared. Stay well, because we are going to need you big time in this 2024 election year. Speaking of which, that election year has now officially begun, as has Donald Trump's attempts, of course, to undermine American democracy. President Joe Biden's campaign on Saturday condemned Republican former President Donald Trump for sidestepping a decades-old Illinois ballot access tradition this past week, in which candidates pledge against advocating for an overthrow of the government. Chicago's NPR affiliate WBEZ published a report on Saturday showing that Trump did not sign the state's loyalty oath as part of his package of ballot access paperwork submitted Thursday to the Illinois State Board of Elections. That omission, coming just days before the third anniversary of the January 6 insurrection, for which he's been criminally charged, is apparently a departure from his presidential candidacies of 2016 and 2020, when he affixed his own signature to that optional voluntary oath both of those times. Under Illinois law, presidential candidates wanting to be on the state's March 19th primary ballot had to turn in their nominating petitions to the state board on Thursday or Friday, and the loyalty oath is a time-honored, though non-mandatory, part of that process. But he signed it before in 2016 and 2020, but for some reason, this year, he decided he did not want to sign that oath.
Gosh, I wonder why Trump would not sign a pledge to not overthrow the government this year.
Biden's campaign spokesperson said in a statement on Saturday, "For the entirety of our nation's history, presidents have put their hands on the Bible, sworn to protect and uphold the Constitution of the United States, and Donald Trump can't bring himself to sign a piece of paper saying he won't attempt a coup to overthrow our government. We know he's serious, deadly serious, because 3 years ago he tried and failed to do exactly that," said the spokesperson. As part of the oath, candidates attest that they, quote, "do not directly or indirectly teach or advocate the overthrow of the government of the United States or any unlawful change in the form of the governments thereof by force or by unlawful means." Countless candidates in flag-waving fashion, notes WBEZ, have signed it throughout the years, even though it is no longer compulsory. But this year, not Trump, which seems to feed precisely into the case that President Biden is making for his reelection, as he launched his official 2024 campaign on Friday in Pennsylvania at Valley Forge, the day before the, yes, third anniversary of Trump's deadly insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Joe Biden's Friday speech, writes Brian Butler, landed in a way that his previous remembrances did not. Butler cites much of the speech's success. What makes it stand out from his earlier comments is that he's shaken off the dated political tick of speaking obliquely or in code or by implication about his opponent. On Friday, instead of naming Donald Trump zero times in the speech, as he has done in recent years, he referred to him 44 times by name. Here are a few of those mentions in a short portion of his remarks on Friday.
Today, we're here to answer the most important of questions. Is democracy still America's sacred cause? I mean it. This is not rhetorical, academic, or hypothetical. Whether democracy is still America's sacred cause is the most urgent question of our time. And it's what the 2024 election is all about. The choice is clear. Donald Trump's campaign is about him, not America, not you. Donald Trump's campaign is obsessed with the past, not the future. He's willing to sacrifice our democracy, put himself in power. Trump is running as the denier-in-chief, the election denier-in-chief. Once again, he's saying he won't honor the results of the election if he loses. Well, he still doesn't understand the basic truth, and that is you can't love your country only when you win. You can't love your country only when you win. For the first time in our history, insurrectionists had come to stop the peaceful transfer of power in America. First time. Smashing windows, shattering doors, attacking the police. Outside, gallows were erected as the MAGA crowd chanted, "Hang Mike Pence." Inside, they hunted for Speaker Pelosi. Over 140 police officers were injured. Jill and I attended the funeral of police officers who died as a result of the events of that day. Because of Donald Trump's lies, they died because these lies brought a mob to Washington. The entire nation watched in horror. The whole world watched in disbelief. And Trump did nothing. It was among the worst derelictions of duty by a president in American history. Trump's mob wasn't a peaceful protest. It was a violent assault. They were insurrectionists, not patriots. They weren't there to uphold the Constitution. They were there to destroy the Constitution. And now these MAGA voices who know the truth about Trump on January 6th have abandoned the truth and abandoned the democracy. They made their choice. Now the rest of us, Democrats, independents, mainstream Republicans, we have to make our choice. So hear me clearly. I'll say what Donald Trump won't. Political violence is never, ever acceptable in the United States political system. Never, never, never. It has no place in a democracy, none. You can't be pro-insurrectionist and pro-American. What's Trump done? Instead of calling them criminals, he's called these insurrectionists patriots. They're patriots. And he promised to pardon them if he returns to office. Trump said that there was a lot of love on January the 6th. The rest of the nation, including law enforcement, saw a lot of hate and violence. In trying to rewrite the facts of January 6th, Trump is trying to steal history the same way he tried to steal the election.
Wait, what did he just say? That was Joe Biden in Valley Forge on Friday. But yeah, you heard him right. The president of the United States has now said, finally, at long last, out loud, yes, Donald Trump tried to steal the 2020 election. Thank you, Mr. President. Had he and other Democrats been willing to do that every single day since January 6, 2021, as I have been trying to urge people to simply say out loud, had he done so, we probably would not be where we are right now with Trump and his MAGA folks on the right being able to question, well, you know, January 6 wasn't really that bad. They were patriots. And now they're being held as political prisoners or as hostages, as Donald Trump has begun referring to them even as Americans are actually being held as real hostages in Gaza as we speak. In any event, better late than never. Now, of course, the question, how do we stop Donald Trump from trying to steal the next presidential election? But on those lines, speaking of better late than never, after 7 long years, that case in Georgia that we have been telling you about endlessly, reporting on for, yes, 7 years, challenging the use of Georgia's terrible, vulnerable, unverifiable touchscreen voting systems, well, that trial is finally set to begin and maybe help prevent Donald Trump from trying to steal the 2024 election again. So those machines will be used again, or at least they are set to right now in 2024 for some reason by Georgia's Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger. And that trial is finally about to get underway this week. But you may be shocked to learn who will not be required to testify. Susan Greenhall of Free Speech for People joins us next for a curtain raiser on the long-awaited Curling v. Raffensperger federal trial in Atlanta. That's straight ahead. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is The Bradcast.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Line it up, baby!
Hey!
Yep. Light it up, Atlanta. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Just before the turn of the new year, the good folks at the nonprofit Nonpartisan Coalition for Good Governance replied to a court motion by Georgia's Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger in his attempt to not appear as a witness in their long-awaited trial against both him and the state of Georgia, seeking to prevent the state's use, once again in 2024, of dangerous, unverifiable, wildly vulnerable touchscreen voting systems made by Dominion, enforced on voters in every single precinct across the state, ordered for some reason by Raffensperger himself, despite all that we know about the swing state of Georgia, about those unverifiable touchscreen systems, and the successful effort by Team Trump on January 7 of 2021 to access, breach, copy, and distribute over the internet the state's exceedingly sensitive voting system software in Coffee County, Georgia. Raffensperger has been attempting to avoid testifying in the long-awaited lawsuit set to begin in federal court on Tuesday under the premise that top elected officials should never be required to testify in a federal trial unless there is no other way to obtain the same information, say from documents or from someone else in the same office who might be able to supply that same information. The U.S. District Judge overseeing the case over the nearly 7 years since it was filed originally in 2017 determined that, yes, absolutely, Secretary Raffensperger must testify. Raffensperger, however, appealed that ruling to the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, attempting to avoid testifying for some reason for just 75 minutes on the stand, as had been agreed to by the plaintiffs. Among the voluminous arguments and evidence put forward in the coalition's 175-page motion at the 11th Circuit, arguing that Raffensperger, yes, must testify, since he holds information that is not available through any other means, well, this passage citing a Q&A deposition with Michael Barnes, who plays a major role in management of Georgia's electronic election system, about the state's examination or lack thereof of voting equipment and servers. Question: do you know why the Secretary's office never performed any forensic examination of any of the voting equipment or the servers? Witness: no, sir, I do not. Question: Who would make that decision on whether to conduct that type of examination? Answer, I believe that would be a decision that would be made by the secretary. Question, do you know if there was ever discussion or consideration of that type of examination of the old system? Answer, I do not know. Or this one, also with Barnes in the secretary's office. Question, but if you're confident that the system is secure, particularly in an environment where there have been extraordinary claims made about the reliability of that system, why not just have an election security expert analyze it, examine it, and offer an opinion on whether it's reliable? Witness, I'm not sure if the Secretary of State decided that he wanted to do that, that that would get done. Question, and as you sit here, you don't know why he's decided, why he's not decided that, right? Witness, I do not. Or this one, with Georgia's chief operations officer for the secretary's office, Gabe Sterling, you've probably heard of him, asking whether Raffensperger had ever read a report detailing serious security vulnerabilities in Georgia's touchscreen voting system. Question, so the secretary himself has not read it? Answer, I don't know. Question, well, you're testifying on behalf of the secretary's office today as a corporate representative, so I'm asking, as a corporate representative, has the secretary himself read this report? Answer, and my answer remains the same, that I don't know. Question, okay, and how would you find out? Answer, I guess I would probably have to call him and ask him. You get the idea. A whole bunch of stuff that can only be answered by Raffensperger, as the U.S. District Judge Amy Totenberg had already agreed to, that he had to testify for just 75 minutes at trial after 7 years of pretrial motions, arguments, and hearings. On page one of their motion, the coalition goes on to quote Raffensperger himself from his own recent book titled Integrity Counts. Insert your own irony there, I guess, where he wrote, quote, the ultimate fact check in the United States occurs in courts of law, where witnesses swear to tell the truth or risk imprisonment, and where lawyers must also tell the truth or risk disbarment. If you want to know the truth, Raffensperger wrote, watch what happens in court. Well, we are watching, Mr. Raffensperger. On Friday, the three-judge panel on the conservative 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals incredibly allowed Raffensperger's petition to not testify at the trial. They gave little explanation. I'll ask my guest joining me momentarily if she has any other explanation for their gobsmacking ruling. The Washington Post's top story on their website on Sunday offered their own lengthy curtain raiser for the trial in federal court in Atlanta beginning this week, in the case that we have been covering on this show in detail since its original filing back in 2017. They begin this way. Mike Lindell, the flamboyant pillow magnate, has spent millions promoting the falsehood that the 2020 election was stolen from Donald Trump, a claim that has been roundly rejected by cybersecurity experts, government officials, and numerous courts. But late last year, Lindell crowed that a federal judge had vindicated him at last. Quote, I get to take off my tinfoil hat, he said on a podcast hosted by former Trump White House advisor Steve Bannon, removing a baseball cap covered in aluminum foil that he had worn as a prop. That's what the judge said. We're not a conspiracy theory guy anymore. Praise the Lord, said Lindell. In fact, the judge had said no such thing. She had not mentioned Lindell at all or the outlandish election fraud claims that he and other Trump allies have advanced. The people, U.S. District Court Judge Amy Totenberg declared to be not conspiracy theorists of any variety, unquote, were the plaintiffs in the lawsuit that was filed in Georgia long before the 2020 election. And in fact, I will note here, it was filed way back in 2017 when guys like Lindell and Bannon were poo-pooing and laughing at the very serious concerns of cybersecurity and voting systems experts about the dangers of unverifiable touchscreen systems. The plaintiffs in this case, led by our friend Marilyn Marks of the Coalition of Good Governance, argue that voting machines at the polling place in Georgia present security risks that state officials, like Raffensperger, are constitutionally obligated to address. And they have the backing of, quote, some of the nation's leading cybersecurity experts and computer scientists, as Judge Totenberg wrote in the particular ruling that Lindell was lying about. Back in 2020, when Raffensperger decided to get these new touchscreen systems rather than move to hand-marked paper ballots, Judge Totenberg warned the new machines presented, quote, true risks. She described the potential for hacking or system breakdown, saying that the plaintiff's cybersecurity experts convincingly present evidence that this is not a question of might this actually ever happen, but when it will happen, especially if further protective measures are not taken. That's according to the judge. The case, in fact, has the backing of most, if not all, of the nation's longtime voting system experts. Real ones, not phony ones like Lindell. Specifically, for example, my guest again today on the broadcast. Now, you may have heard lately of the nonpartisan, nonprofit good government group named FreeSpeechForPeople.org. You may have heard their name of late, as they have been behind a number of the cases challenging Donald Trump's qualification to run for president in 2024 after appearing to have violated Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, the so-called Insurrection Clause. While we've seen a lot of coverage over the last several weeks of 14.3, finally in the corporate media, the broadcast, well, we've been talking to listeners about this and the potential for disqualification for at least 2 years on this show, often with experts from, yes, Free Speech for People. In addition to being far ahead of the pack on that matter, the good folks at FSFP have also long been far ahead of the curve when it comes to concerns about voting systems, like the 100% unverifiable, easily hacked touchscreen voting systems that are now still set to be used at the polling places in Georgia, despite expert warnings against their use, especially following the breach, copy, and distribution of those systems by Lindell's Team MAGA friends in Coffee County, Georgia, the day after the notorious January 6 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. A breach which you also most likely heard about first on this program, as we were the first to air the notorious phone call to Marilyn Marks from one of the breach coordinators, a guy by the name of Scott Hall, who has now pleaded guilty to his role in the scheme as part of Fani Willis's criminal conspiracy case against Trump and 18 co-conspirators in Fulton County, Georgia. Despite learning about the breach early on, it was over a year before Raffensperger sought an investigation of the matter from law enforcement, and it's unclear if his office did any investigation into the matter on their own. That, of course, is just one of the many questions plaintiffs will not be able to ask of the secretary now at this week's trial. Joining us now from FreeSpeechForPeople.org is their senior advisor on election security, who, in addition to joining us many times over the years to discuss this case, has also worked closely with Marilyn Marks and the Coalition for Good Governance over the past 7 years since this very same federal case first succeeded in winning a ban on Georgia's older touchscreen systems that were made by Diebold, only to see them replaced by Secretary of State Raffensperger, in defiance of experts, with very similar touchscreen systems with many of the same flaws and security holes as made by Dominion. Susan Greenhall, Happy New Year. And welcome back to the broadcast on the eve of the long-awaited Curling v. Raffensperger federal trial.
Great to be here. Happy New Year to you too, Brad, and to all your listeners.
Thank you so much. Susan, I know that you will be following this very closely as it unfolds in the weeks ahead. You were instrumental in a number of the findings that have already occurred because of this trial, including the Coffee County voting system breach, which was part of the pretrial discovery. That's why we know about it at all. The lengthy Washington Post piece on Sunday went on to report, quote, A favorable outcome for the plaintiffs would have extraordinary implications. Georgia, one of the swing states that decided the last presidential election, could head into the 2024 cycle with machines that a federal judge has deemed dangerously vulnerable to security breaches, even as the piece in the Post is careful to report right up front that the plaintiffs have argued the Dominion systems in Georgia are, quote, vulnerable to hacking, not that they have actually been hacked. I know we've discussed this before, but I guess we have to underscore it now each time. Have the curling plaintiffs found any actual evidence in all of these years that the systems were actually hacked in either the 2020 or 2022 elections in the state? And frankly, does whether they were hacked or not already actually matter either way to the plaintiffs moving forward?
So, no, the plaintiffs in curling have never alleged that any machines were hacked and that an election was wrongly decided. They, you know, are clearly not of the same ilk as the election deniers that have been, you know, wreaking havoc on our election system over the last several years with baseless and outrageous, unfounded accusations of stolen elections. But they have found significant vulnerabilities, engineering and design flaws with the systems. And the thing is that no system is perfect. We want to have a system that is resilient and reliable, transparent and trustworthy. But you can't make a computer system completely unhackable. Unfortunately, these touchscreen ballot marking devices are extraordinarily badly secured. But if you have a reliable record of the voters' selections recorded on a piece of paper with a pen, you can always reconstruct and recount the election in a reliable manner. You can use new equipment if there's a problem with the way the votes are being counted. So you can use different equipment, you can count them by hand, you can always go back and make sure that the count is correct. But if the record of the vote is incorrect and it's recorded incorrectly because you're using unreliable, badly engineered machines that are susceptible to attacks, then your election's basically in irretrievable trouble.
And this is something that we've, the people who understand how these voting systems work and understand that the systems in Georgia that you have to use if you want to vote at the polling place across the state, you can vote on a hand-marked paper ballot if you, vote by mail or absentee and so forth. But this is something that is easily understandable if you understand how these systems work and the threats that they actually do present, whether there is evidence of hacking or not. Nonetheless, we've seen how, the MAGA crowd have been disingenuously latching on to this suit and their baseless claims that the election was stolen. That has frightened Democrats who, once warned of the dangers of these very systems. Now suddenly they're sort of running scared of supporting the curling lawsuit, I think, for fear of giving Team MAGA something to use to falsely claim fraud. How much of a problem has that become for the plaintiffs in recent years in this lawsuit and for a potential ruling by a federal district judge who's been appointed by Barack Obama? Is this a concern in the trial itself?
I hope that it wouldn't have an impact on the judge. I hope the judge is just going to look at the facts and the law and realize that there's no question that the plaintiff should prevail. Mm-hmm. As far as regarding the court of public opinion, it's a huge problem to be able to get the support of Democrats and progressives to understand this. And the Secretary of State's office has very cynically, and I would argue maliciously, repeatedly tried to paint the curling plaintiffs as election deniers. There's been statement after statement in the press. The Secretary of State's office has been admonished by the judge in the case for trying to smear the plaintiffs in curling as big lie election deniers. He and his attorneys have not heeded those warnings. the judge also, as you cited earlier in your introduction, made it clear that the curling plaintiffs are not election deniers. But this is a problem, and it keeps people from addressing what are real issues with our election system. Just because people who are lying about our election system are saying that the election was stolen doesn't mean these other issues of the vulnerabilities, insufficiently secured, et cetera, that's still not a problem. And it extends in a lot of different ways. And I'll just give an example in that in another state, I think there might be some interest to try and get rid of these machines. And there's been some outreach from some members of the Republican Party to do that, to myself and to some other people that have worked on it. But they're concerned that they won't be able to get the other side of the aisle to join them because of the way the whole discussion has been poisoned by the big lie. On another front, as your listeners might recall, Free Speech for People has been leading the call for a federal investigation into the effort by Trump's allies and attorneys to unlawfully take voting system software, the software that counts the votes, from Georgia, from Michigan, from Pennsylvania, from several states that we know, thanks to the curling plaintiffs that uncovered this in their discovery, not thanks to the Georgia state law enforcement because they ignored it.
Right.
But thanks to the curling plaintiffs, they uncovered this scheme that goes all the way up to Sidney Powell. We believe it also goes up to the White House because there's evidence it was discussed with Donald Trump in the White House to take the software improperly. This has gone on through many, many states, and it's been coordinated and the software has been shared amongst Trump allies and election deniers. And yet there is still no federal investigation or no evidence of any federal investigation. And we have been trying to engage lawmakers to call on the Department of Justice to investigate this. And I've been told, it's been raised with me by staffers, that it could be problematic to talk about this because it is a election security issue, and they don't want to discourage people from voting by letting them know or highlighting the fact that Trump's allies have stolen the software that runs our elections,
which is just,
it might diminish confidence in our elections. My response to that is the best way to demonstrate our election systems are secure is to hold the people accountable who have done these potentially illegal activities, and we shall see how that pans out. But yes, it's been a huge problem, and what has been exacerbated by the fact that the Secretary of State's office has tried to leverage that to his advantage to discredit the plaintiffs in curling.
Yeah, and nonetheless, sticking your head in the sand doesn't help. I mean, I remember before the 2020 election, and maybe it was when you were on the show or Marilyn Marks was on the show, we were discussing it, that the fact was that, you know, Team Trump, I had warned that, oh, when they complain about the results after the election, they'll be able to cite places like Georgia with their 100% unverifiable touchscreen systems, places in Philadelphia that use very similar systems, to claim that the election was stolen from them, whether it was or wasn't. Because of how those systems work, it's difficult, if not impossible, to prove that the ballots counted, the results counted, were actually what the voters wanted. Instead, Team Trump ended up citing, you know, evidence-free claims about Italian satellites changing the results and China dropping secret bamboo ballots, you know, into the tabulation. Dead Hugo Chavez changing the results. That's my personal favorite because it was based on an old story of mine, an accurate one at the time. Ballot mules, you know, stuffing the box. But I was always surprised they didn't cite the concerns about these particular touchscreens. It underscores, you know, how little they actually understood those systems at the time. But they could have made those claims and we would have no real response to it because of the way these systems work. Well, they're a lot smarter this year. And if those systems are used again, they definitely could make that claim this year. And it would be very hard to dispute, Susan.
Absolutely. As it's been documented so well, the curling plaintiff's expert examined the system and raised very significant security vulnerabilities, as I mentioned, that are the result of poor software engineering and design of the system. Things that could have been avoided if they'd done a better job and hired better people. Mm-hmm. So these systems have these inherent security flaws. And then the report from the expert, Professor Alex Halderman from University of Michigan, was shared with the court's permission with the Department of Homeland Security's cybersecurity arm. Mm-hmm. And they confirmed the same vulnerabilities and said, yes, all these vulnerabilities exist. And that's ways that you can compromise and corrupt the system. Mm-hmm. So that's some pretty strong, conclusive scientific evidence that these machines are vulnerable and could be compromised, that could end up in lawsuits going forward. And it would be really very, 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 very concerning if Georgia had to go forward and hold their elections on these machines
on
in 2024.
On these machines. Susan Greenhall, as the trial begins finally at long last on Tuesday, in the simplest possible terms, what will the plaintiffs be laying out at this trial against Georgia and Secretary Raffensperger?
Well, they have a very strong case. So first, they can show without a shadow of a doubt that there are inherent security vulnerabilities mm-hmm. in these machines. As I mentioned, that this was found by their scientific expert and confirmed by the Department of Homeland Security. And the secretary's response and defense to that has always been, well, it's going to be, yeah, there's these vulnerabilities, but you would have to have full access to the machines to be able to exploit it. And that never happens. Well, the plaintiffs then, as I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. discovered the fact that allies of Donald Trump and Sidney Powell were hired to go in and copy access the voting system software with the approval of the supervisor of elections of Coffee County, a small rural county in southern Georgia. They obtained copies of the voting system software, which enables anybody who's a malicious actor with some level of skill to probe it for vulnerabilities, find out how to compromise it. There's a lot of bad things that they can do with that software now that they have it. They still have it. They've distributed it to more of their election denier friends. And there is, as I mentioned earlier, no federal investigation or attempt to find out how far and wide that software has been shared. So the secretary's defense that nobody can actually access the machines, they wouldn't actually know how they run because they've never seen the software, and then they wouldn't actually ever be able to get in there, is just patently false. It's demonstrably untrue. Security experts have long warned that insider attack, mm-hmm. Meaning that an insider with access to a system can be coerced or bribed or threatened or maybe just sympathetic to the cause to allow access to sensitive systems like voting systems, it's your number one threat when you're trying to secure sensitive, valuable systems. And there's no doubt it's happened. So I don't see how the Secretary of State can defend against
it. And yet, it seems to be something that, based on all of these years of pretrial motions, orders, and so forth, that the judge seems to understand, Judge Totenberg. She has made clear, this is according to the Washington Post, that she, however, cannot order the state to adopt paper ballots marked by hand and then scanned and tallied by machines, the kind of system favored by the plaintiffs, used by the majority of voters across America. That she says she can't order that. She has said, however, that if she finds deficiencies in the current systems, she could order, quote, pragmatic, sound, remedial policies, such as new security measures. So what does that mean? Even if she finds these systems to be wildly flawed, she cannot order a move to verifiable hand-marked paper ballots? We could well be stuck with these systems anyway, even if she rules in favor of the plaintiff?
I think what she's saying is the courts can't tell the states how to run their elections. Mm-hmm. But I think she does have the authority to say, you can't run your elections on this machine because it doesn't protect your constitutional right to vote sufficiently, which she's already done in, as you mentioned, when she ruled that the DREs couldn't be used anymore.
Yeah, back in 2019, they got rid of the Diebold machines, replaced them with the Dominion machines based on her ruling in this case.
That's right. So I would expect that there's no reason she couldn't have a similar ruling like that. Now, the thing with the ballot marking devices and you know, as I'm sure your audience is pretty familiar with, that they print out a piece of paper, and then that piece of paper is walked over to a scanner, and the scanner counts the ballot, mm-hmm. the paper ballot. And the electronic touchscreen voting machine is essentially a very, very, very expensive, insecure pen to mark the ballot, right. But you can't trust it because it's not as if you have to worry about your pen not marking your ballot exactly where you put the tip.
Right.
So what the plaintiffs have argued is all you need to do is lift out the ballot marking device out of the system because the scanners that they use in Georgia will count hand marked paper ballots. They won't need any other new equipment. They will be relieved of the burden of having to program all of those machines, stock them with paper and ink, distribute them through trucks, carry them in and out of polling locations, get them hooked up to electrical outlets. They will not have to do any of that. Instead, they can just give pre-printed hand-marked paper ballots or ballots that will be hand-marked to the voters in a polling location and hand them a pen.
But my understanding is she can't necessarily order that specifically, but do I understand it right that if she puts enough security requirements on to what they can do, that someone like Raffensperger may say, well, the only way to meet those security requirements would be to move to hand-marked paper ballots?
I don't necessarily read it that way, but I'm not a lawyer. So my understanding is she's saying I can't order a certain type of election, you know, that you run your elections this way. Like, so I would think it would be conceivable that she could say, you can't use these machines for the for every voter that comes into the polling location and require them to use it without offering, you know, giving an option for paper ballot or use options for people with disabilities. So if the state wanted to go out and buy a bunch of ES&S ballot marking devices, I would assume that, and again, I'm not a lawyer, but the way, you know, they could do that, that would be stupid. But the easiest thing then to do would be to just use hand paper ballots because, as I mentioned, the system they have can process them
would already work, which is why it's so, and I've got just a minute or so left here, Susan, which is why it's so insane that the plaintiffs will not be able to ask questions of Secretary Raffensperger, the guy who insists on using these machines. Do you understand at all the 11th Circuit's ruling on Friday that Raffensperger is not required to testify? I read the coalition's 175 brief explaining why he must testify and the, you know, two paragraph explanation from the 11th Circuit panel that he doesn't have to. It seems to defy reason. Do you have any reason to explain this to me?
No, I think that opinion was absolutely devoid of reason, unfortunately. If you read Judge Totenberg's order saying that he does have to testify, it was very clear that there is certain information that he really needs to be the person answering to, as you had highlighted. It's incredible that there's so many different questions. Like, for example, you raised the thing about why haven't you done a security analysis of the system.
Yes.
We know the Secretary's office has done security reviews of other parts of their system that don't deal with the actual voting process, things within their office and so forth. They've also ordered their security reviewer not to provide any reports in writing any longer, to only give them orally, which is really strange.
That is.
So there's a lot of questions surrounding that one piece that really Raffensperger really should be answering.
Well, and he won't be able to answer it, I guess, or he won't be required to. Is there enough evidence quickly to win this case without Raffensperger on the stand, do you think, Susan?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's a lot of questions that really should have been coming answered from Raffensperger, but they still have the overwhelming evidence. I'm not concerned about that.
Well, that actually is quite encouraging to hear. I'm still concerned about it, but I'm concerned about everything. In fact, I'm concerned about, you know, the fact that these same systems or very similar ones are used in jurisdictions in more than a dozen states around the country. So what happens in Georgia, as usual, may be very important to the rest of the country. I got to get out. How long is this trial set to run, Susan? And are you going to be in Atlanta over the course?
2 to 3 weeks, I believe.
Okay. Well, we may be bothering you quite a bit over the next 2 to 3 weeks. I hope you don't mind. I thank you in advance for keeping us up to date on how it's going. Thank you again for joining us. Susan Greenhall is the longtime indefatigable election integrity and transparency expert and advocate over at freespeechforpeople.org. You can find her on the Twitters at S.E. Greenhall. And of course, Free Speech for People is FSFP or freespeechforpeople.org. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you, Brad.
Okay, we got to get out. It's going to be a hell of a bumpy year.
Yes, and I have to say it is shocking and telling that Raffensperger has ordered their security reviewer reports to be delivered orally and not in writing. Gosh, why might that be?
Now, why would he want to do that? Good Lord. This trial doesn't come a moment too soon. We got to get out. Thanks again to Susan. Thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen. Thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It is greatly appreciated. It is much an honor. And thank you for waiting for us until we could get better from the COVIDs. Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, I am The Brad Blog. We will, you can download our shows anytime via bradblog.com for free. Thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate. All right, that's it. We will see you at all of the above. Until we see you here next time, hopefully tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.